Welcome to Mind Food Radio, Smart Thinking with Michael McHugh and Ben Starr.
It's another episode of Mind Food Radio, and Michael and Ben with you. How are you, Michael?
Very good. How are you this week?
Very, very well. Another jam-packed show today. Lee Hodder not too far away.
It sure is. Now, she's talking about SAD. Do you know what SAD stands for?
No, but we'll find out in a few seconds. It's got something to do with depression, I imagine.
Well, yes, it does. And
it's the opposite of happy.
Exactly. And it's all about something seasonal. And, of course, we're into the garden with Angus.
Fantastic. What else is coming up on today's program?
Well, we've got John McRae, the photographer who was the very last photographer who photographed Margaret Holley.
That's a really interesting story.
Yeah, 3 weeks before she died. A fascinating story and a beautiful photograph that he won a major award for.
I love the photos. And who else on today's program?
Well, it's been over 10 years now since the Bali bombings, and we've got an extraordinary story, a My Story, from Corinne Smith, who shares with her struggle, I guess, over the last 10 years of putting her life back together.
All that and more. And of course, jump onto mindfood.com to go in the draw to win some fabulous prizes.
Mind Food Magazine and Mind Food Radio. Together, smart thinking.
And thank you for joining us today on Mind Food Radio, wherever you are, at home, at work, or driving in the car. We're live at your place. And of course, for more details on anything that we do on the radio show, you can log on to mindfood.com. Lee Hodder's joining us on the line now, talking about seasonal affective disorder, or SAD. How are you, Michael? You're looking a little bit happy.
Oh, no.
How are you, Lee?
I'm well. How are you?
Good.
Now, this is a really interesting disorder, and a lot of people suffer this, don't they, Lee?
Yes, they do. It's a depressive illness that actually has a seasonal pattern, typically associated with winter and less exposure to light. But what I've also found is that it can relate to summer and too much light.
Oh, it can have the opposite effect.
Yeah, apparently so.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it occurs more often perhaps in women than men, and it may actually begin during the teen years. Is that right?
That's correct. It's four times more common in women. It can onset at any age, but the average age of onset is around about 23 years or so.
Now, that just seems such a long, long time. It is a kind of depression, isn't it?
Yes, it is associated with a depression. It's usually diagnosed when the person has had the symptoms for 2 years or more in a row.
And what are the symptoms? What would be the symptoms?
Oh, people, if we're looking at winter onset, people who might have, you know, very normal mental health throughout the rest of the year, they tend to slow down, they comfort eat, they gain weight, they sleep more. They have a lot less energy, they socially isolate themselves, they can have crying spells, irritability, fatigue and anxiety.
Mm. Now, there's no test, though, is there, for SAD?
I believe someone's working on an assessment tool for it as we speak, but usually what we'll find is that if the person reports that they've got normal mental health throughout the rest of the year and then they've had these symptoms 2 years in a row, I think that's when a diagnosis will kick in. What actually happens is that there's a gland in the middle of the brain called the pineal gland that secretes a hormone called melatonin, which regulates our sleep-wake cycle. And with less exposure to light, it comes out of balance. So what we ask people to do is try to get as much exposure to light before 8 a.m. that they can. Exercise outdoors in the sun, and there's actually a thing called light therapy that's been used for about 20 years or so with people who are experiencing SAD. Apparently the lights that are used in it have to be 25 times brighter than the average lounge room light.
Now, you mentioned before that you should get light before 8 a.m. Is that right, you said?
Yeah, that's correct.
Why before 8 a.m.?
It helps to regulate the sleep cycle. What we find with people with SAD is that they tend to just sort of have whole doona days. They just stay in bed for most of that time.
Mm.
They don't get up early, and by doing that, they're actually probably making the problem worse.
Because it just keeps repeating itself.
Yeah, it does. Mm. It does.
And then you go to sleep at night, then you don't sleep and you wake up and it's...
Exactly.
Yep.
Exactly. People can also see their doctors and get medication for this, antidepressant medication, and they can also use very carefully monitored melatonin supplements. Apparently they've had some beneficial effect on it as well.
And Lee, have you seen, or has there been a big growth in this, or is it just that we're more aware of this disorder?
I think we're probably just more aware of this disorder.
Yeah.
Usually, from what my research says, it's more likely to occur in Australia from Canberra and below.
Okay.
Yeah, which is interesting. But what I'm finding here in Brisbane, because we've had so much rain, and we've just had, you know, weeks and weeks and weeks without sun, is it's probably actually picking up a bit here as well.
Well, Lee, look, thank you for joining us today. Very interesting topic. And for more details, mindfood.com.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
This is Mind Food Radio, smart thinking.
And welcome back to Mind Food Radio. Well, spring is just around the corner, not that you'd know it, but here's some tips and tricks from Angus Stewart. How are you, Angus?
I'm very good, thanks, Ben.
I tell you what, spring is around the corner, so what are some good things that we could start looking to do in our gardens to spice things up?
Well, one of the best things I think you can do is get out and look at other people's gardens. Going for walks around your district and seeing what other people are growing and how those plants are performing is, I think, one of my key sort of inspirational tips for gardeners as to how to really get your own garden looking good. You know, as opposed to what I think most people tend to do is go to the nursery and buy on impulse.
Yeah.
They see a plant in flower and they go, oh, beautiful. And the problem with doing that is it may not be appropriate for your garden or your soil and all that sort of stuff. So and then you end up spending a whole lot of money and putting in a whole lot of effort and then being disappointed in the results.
And then I suppose the other problem that people do is they only buy one of it.
Yes, that's another issue. I think planting in threes is one of my rules in the garden. If I can get hold of three plants of something, a little triangle often makes a beautiful sort of display.
Now, what about people that just say, look, you know, they're not committed to doing it every weekend in the garden and they just want to do a nice garden that's going to sort of self-look after itself and they only have to do minimal maintenance? What do you recommend in that area?
I recommend shrubberies because what you can do is put in plants that, if you select carefully, and this goes back to what I was saying earlier about checking out other people's gardens and looking how they're working, because with a lot of spring flowering shrubs particularly, you get this burst of colour and they look fabulous, and all you then need to do is get in and just prune behind the flowers after they've finished, and that will keep the plant looking good for the whole year.
Look, I went to the local hardware store the other day and I'm standing in the aisle and I thought to myself, well, spring is around the corner and look at this aisle. What do I use to fertilise the garden here? There's so many choices.
Well, that is a can be a real dilemma too, because some plants, like certain Australian native plants, just need low phosphorus fertilisers. So you really need to, I suppose, do a little bit of research on the plants that you're growing, and there are specific fertilisers for plants like those phosphorus-sensitive Australian natives, for instance. So making sure that you group those plants together in the garden as well, so when you do fertilise, you're giving them their specific fertiliser and not doing any damage to the plants around them, for instance.
Well, fantastic. I did some damage to myself. I got home with a 39-kilo bag of Dynamic Lifter and I nearly broke my back, and I've got something like 79 camellias to start feeding up in the next few weeks.
Yes. You know, we're often sort of led to believe that there is a general purpose fertiliser that you can put on everything.
Yep.
And unfortunately that can lead to some disasters apart from putting your back out.
Yeah, apart from putting your back out. Yeah, but it can actually burn plants and kill them, can't it?
Well, indeed. And Dynamic Lifter, for instance, is, you know, it's a fantastic fertiliser for, say, lawns and vegetable gardens that need a very high level of fertility. But, you need to be careful with those, say, native plants that like a lower level of nutrition and get the appropriate fertiliser for them. So it really is a matter of horses for courses.
It is indeed. Well, Angus, thanks for joining us today on the program. Interesting tips and tricks for spring, and we'll talk to you next time here on Mind Food Radio.
Good on you, Ben. Thanks.
Mind Food Radio, smart thinking with Michael McHugh and Ben Starr.
It's Mind Food Radio, and we're now heading into another really interesting topic, Carmichael.
We are. We're talking to photographer John McRae, and he was the People Choice winner at this year's National Photographic Portrait Prize that they hold at the National Portrait Gallery in Canberra.
Mm-hmm.
Welcome to the show, John.
Thank you. Thanks, Michael.
Now, yours is a beautiful portrait. It's of the late Margaret Olley, and it's a really lovely story how you came to take her portrait. Tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah, well, I was approached by Robin Berkeley from Berkeley Editions some time ago to do a giclée print of one of Margaret's works. They were looking for a high-quality printer at the time, and I became known to Robin, and Robin approached me. So I actually photographed one of Margaret's works and generated a giclée print, kind of a high-quality inkjet print. And when Margaret saw the print, she was really happy because I think historically she'd been a little bit suspicious, you know, of printing. Often artists are, because their works are not really reproduced faithfully enough. Mm. Anyway, she was really happy with it, and as a result she wanted to meet with me, and I did. I met Margaret, which was fantastic, and she asked me to photograph the works for her forthcoming exhibition, actually. So that's how it came about, and then I started up a professional relationship with Margaret over that time.
What was she like, John?
I had known Margaret through her reputation only, through her work. I had never met her. But she was, once I met her, she was beautiful. She was a lovely woman. She worked like a Trojan. I mean, every time I went to visit her, she was in front of a canvas working. She'd have about 10 or 15 canvases around her. And I was just impressed with how on the ball she was.
What was the space like, though? Like, I know you also have taken photographs of the space she worked and lived in. What was that like?
Well, that was amazing. It was like walking into a fantasy land, something like Alice in Wonderland.
Mm.
I mean, when I took her portrait, I actually went not intending to take her portrait at that time because I thought I wanted to get some shots of the studio because it's just like it's an amazing cacophony of objects, of dried flowers, of books, of papers, of paintings, gold statues. It was quite an amazing environment, and I thought I'd love to get a shot of it. And I thought, well, why don't I? I'll just, you know, she can always say no, so I'll just take my camera. So I grabbed my camera and I took it in on one visit, and I said, Margaret, do you mind if I take a few shots of the studio? She said, no, love, go ahead.
Now, the portrait itself is broken down into three parts. Did you see that when you first took the initial portrait? Like, how did you come to do that?
Well, towards the end, I started taking some shots of the studio, and once I'd finished, I thought, well, while I'm here, why don't I take, you know, obviously take a shot of Margaret.
Mm.
She was sitting in her chair, so it wasn't a planned portrait. And then at the end, I said, Margaret, do you mind if you sit for me and I take a few shots of you? So I just manoeuvred myself into a position in front of her where she was sitting. She turned to me, and we really only did quite a few frames together.
Mm.
She just turned, and really the first frame was the frame that I chose. It was the first shot.
She has such an inquisitive look on her face. Mm. For those listening today, you can go online, or it's in our July edition.
It's very candid. There's not any strong identity there. It's quite open. And this is a woman like 3 weeks before her death.
Don, did she see the portrait before she died?
Yes, she did. And I think she left it actually on the table because I noticed it. I noticed it on her table in the documentary that they did on her. They sort of panned across her studio, and the camera rested on the portrait, so she must have left it there.
Wow. John McRae, photographer, thank you very much for being on today's show.
My pleasure.
The photographer who took the last image of Margaret Olley before she died.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you, Ben. Cheers.
Today I'd like to welcome to the show Karine Smith. Hi, Karine.
Hi, Hi, how are you?
Now, it's hard to believe that it was almost 10 years ago that Bali was rocked in one of the world's most deadliest terrorist attacks. It's a memory that you live with every day as the events claimed the lives of two of your closest friends and almost your own. You travelled to Bali with your two girlfriends to commemorate that one-year anniversary of your de facto partner's suicide. No one was aware, though, that your intent was also to take your own life in Bali. So take us through, take us back to those days in Bali, those very sad days in Bali.
I guess the time leading up to Bali was the saddest. I was actually only in Bali for a few hours before the blast. The days leading up to flying out to Bali was all, you know, in anticipation of my partner's 12-month anniversary. And I spent the 12 months prior, I guess, as you said before, spiralling into the depths of despair and the depths of depression where there didn't seem to be any logical choice for me other than taking my own life because I couldn't live with the guilt of what I felt I'd done because I felt very responsible for him taking his life. And I felt that I couldn't live with myself. I couldn't live with what I'd done. I couldn't live with the thoughts that I was having. I couldn't live with what I'd done to his friends and what I'd done to his family, and I really didn't feel that I deserved to be here. You know, my intention was to leave a lovely long letter of telling them everybody how much I loved them and explain to them that, you know, I was back in my rightful place with my partner and life, you know, could return to some level of normality. And I really reconciled that everybody would be okay with that. So going to Bali was really the culmination. It was the end step for me, because the decision had been made, I'd made peace with it, and his anniversary was the 14th of October, and we flew out to Bali on the 12th of October and arrived at 2 p.m. on the 12th.
When your friends died in the Bali bomb, did you feel guilty then too?
Unbelievably.
Because surely it would have been easier for you then to perhaps suicide.
You know, it was quite uncanny because I'd gone to Bali to take my own life, but then I found myself in a fight for it because I'd been severely injured. And the doctors had told me that I had a six-hour window, and if I wasn't operated on in Bali, because my skull had been crushed and was cutting off the blood supply to the brain, and the doctors told me that if I wasn't operated on, I would have a window of 6 hours to live. So I made a decision there and then that I was going to live, and I was going to see my family again, and I was going to hug them again. And if I died after that, well, all well and good, but I wasn't going to die until I'd seen my family. Now, you know, prior to Bali, I didn't have that perspective. All I had was the perspective of suicide. When I came home and discovered that my two friends had been killed, I now just had to live with the guilt and the responsibility of what I'd done, because now I was responsible for losing my partner and two friends. They wouldn't have been in Bali had it not been for me, because Jodie only really came to support me. She didn't want me to be on my own during my partner's anniversary.
What has it taken to get you there to forgive yourself?
When I was writing the book, I had the opportunity to relive every moment. So I think the forgiveness came in me realising that if I'd known better, I would have done better. And if things were different, perhaps I would have been different. But it was what it was. So there's a level of acceptance in my forgiveness.
Kareen, thank you so much for being on today's show. I know your story will help many listeners out there. It's a fascinating story. I'm so thrilled that you have written a book. The book is called Soul Survivor. It's released in September. For more details, go to mindfood.com. But great to have you on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Mind Food Magazine and Mind Food Radio. Together, smart thinking.
We always have interesting topics here on today's program, and we're now going to the area of sleep.
We sure are, in a brand new book called The Sleep Diet. And I guess as a society, we're sleeping far less than we ever have before and carrying more weight than we've ever had time, and I guess in human history. So I'd like to welcome to the show Dr. Carmel Harrington. Hi, Carmel.
Oh, hi, Ben. Hi, Michael.
Now, this is a fascinating book. I guess it's all about why sleeping well is the missing link to permanent weight loss.
That's right, yes.
Could it be something as simple as a good night's sleep?
Can be as simple as a good night's sleep, but of course there's many people in our society who just don't know how to get a good night's sleep, try as they might. And there's other people in our society who, don't give value to sleep, so they just sleep when they've finished everything else. So their busy day ends up finishing at 12 and they've got to be up at 6, so they're actually not getting enough sleep. So there's a whole series of reasons why people don't get enough sleep.
Mm.
Our grandparents actually slept on average between 8.5 to 8.9 hours a night, and we sleep on average about 7 hours a night. So we've knocked down an awful lot of sleep, and we've actually eroded it by doing all sorts of other things, you know, working longer, there's more leisure activities, there's more money in our society to do things. And people, after a certain amount of point of time, people aren't getting the enjoyment they anticipated getting. And one of the, if you think about when you slept well, you know, you're so energised and so motivated and you're happy.
Mm, yeah.
And when you don't sleep well, you're not happy.
No,
you know,
that's
you
true.
Really have, you know, lack of sleep is associated with depression and poor mood state.
Mm.
And so I think people are finally deciding, look, I really want good sleep. But for some people, we've actually lost the art of knowing how to sleep or getting good consolidated sleep.
How important do you think is a sleep routine?
Some people, at various times in their life, can sleep no matter what. They could sleep under a table, they're so tired and, you know, they have no problems with sleep. But always in our life, we're going to come to a time when sleep is elusive, and it might be because a relationship break up, it could be because we've got a new job or just got a level of anxiety about something going on.
Yep.
And in those times, a sleep routine is absolutely essential. And if we don't practice good sleep routine, then we won't be able to access it in those essential times. It's a bit like having an exercise routine or knowing what right foods to eat.
Shift work has a huge impact on people too, doesn't it?
It's massive, and I have been, in the book I talk about, you know, it's actually a looming public health issue. People who do shift work are much more vulnerable to develop all sorts of chronic diseases.
Mm.
And it's because for two reasons. A, they don't get enough sleep on the whole, and also they're working in the night hours when our body is meant to be sleeping. So they're working against their innate body rhythm.
In the world that we live in, though, this 24-hour society, it's got to be a bit of a worry, and it's got to be something that's going to grow, all these shift work people and the illnesses that are going to start to arise.
Well, you're absolutely correct there. And this is one of the reasons for the book. We need to, if we don't understand what sleep gives us, we can minimise it, can't we? We can say, look, we're not worried about sleep. I can do whatever I like. I can sleep at the end of the day. And the idea of this book is to educate people about the importance of sleep.
Mm.
I actually think we're at the same point with sleep as we were with exercise and food 30, 40 years ago. Because,
yep.
Like, when my mother had no, you know, she didn't think we had to put in exercise every day into our life. And that's exercise, the importance of exercise wasn't recognised. It is today.
Mm.
But with sleep, we're just at the start of this, wow, sleep is really important. And we have, if we're not going to do it, at least make an informed choice. Let's know what we're giving up and we choose not to sleep.
Well, Dr. Carmel Harrington, thank you very much for joining us today on the program. Very interesting topic, the author of The Sleep Diet. Michael's just waking up. He's fallen asleep. He's become so relaxed.
And look, to get Dr. Harrington's book, it's on sale now. Or for more details, go to mindfood.com.
Mind Food Magazine and Mind Food Radio. Together, smart thinking.
It's Mind Food Radio. Now, I've been practicing mindfulness.
Have you?
Yeah. I actually thought one night I'll brush my teeth with the opposite hand. And let me tell you, it is difficult. And the thoughts that were coming into my mind at the time, because you know how they say other things will take over. Well, the first thought was, this is really difficult. I don't know whether I can do this anymore, but there you go.
Look, I'd like to welcome to today's show Dr. Stephen McKenzie, who has over 20 years of experience in researching and teaching a broad range of psychological areas, but he is the new author of a book called Mindfulness for Life. Welcome to the show, Stephen.
Thank you.
So what's the book all about?
Well, it's about how mindfulness can just help everybody in their daily life. It can help people who have various psychological or physical conditions, but it can help just everybody to live their life more enjoyably.
So how do you practice mindfulness?
It's just a matter of being aware. It's a matter of being aware of what is rather than trying to escape from what is by thinking about the past or the future. So it's just about fully connecting with what is.
So how do you practice that? For anyone listening today, how do you actually practice mindfulness?
Well, it's really just about fully connecting with what's in front of us. So if we're eating, then it's a matter of not doing something else at the same time as we're eating, but just being fully connected with it, fully tasting the food, fully smelling the food, fully seeing it, and that can be an easier experiment for some people to try with a glass of wine rather than something to eat. But it's a very natural process of just fully connecting to it.
So what you're saying is go for a walk, but don't take the iPhone with you to listen to music or take telephone calls.
Oh, exactly, just to really do what we're doing. If we're playing with a child, just to do it, not be worrying about the mortgage, just to totally connect with what we're doing. It's really very simple and very natural, and a very young child is a good teacher of mindfulness because that's what they do naturally.
I mean, from a psychological point of view, like when we all grew up as kids, we didn't have all this technology. You know, and when you talk to young people today, they sort of stand there and they look at you and they go, you're serious? You used to pull a truck around the block with your brother and play cars and do those sort of things. But is it really about living in the present?
That's right. It's just being really connected with what we're doing. And that means it can be a lot easier to do that. As you say, it was probably easier when we were younger because there are less distractions. And so just to be connected with one thing instead of trying to do several things at once is really a good starting point.
Do you meditate? Can I ask you that?
Yes, I do practice the formal mindfulness process.
And how important do you think is the art of meditation in people's lives?
I think it's very important because it helps us just to come back to what is and to not get overwhelmed with things, not to react to things. We're in a position better when we're being mindful. We're in a position where we can respond rather than react. In other words, to maintain consciousness instead of having our consciousness distracted or distorted by things. And certainly the process of formal meditation, and in the case of a mindfulness meditation, this just means basically going through the body, because one of the beauties of the sensations of the body is that they take place right here in the present moment.
But for people listening today, and, you know, say if they find themselves in a stressful situation, it might be at work or it might be at home, how can they immediately go to that place that does relax them?
Well, a key to mindfulness is really letting go, because we tend to hang on to things and we tend to hang on to so many things that our minds get cluttered. And so mindfulness helps us get into a state. It's like a mental floating. It's just a state of letting go of those thoughts which we think is so important. We tend to identify with our minds and think that we are our thoughts, all those busy circling thoughts, which would be a sad thing, but we're actually more than our thoughts. And mindfulness, a lot of mindfulness is just letting go of that incessant thinking that we tend to engage in.
Dr. Stephen McKenzie, it's great to have you on the show today. Thanks for your time.
It's been a pleasure.
It's Mind Food Radio. Michael, you've been travelling. Everywhere you go, people are reading a particular book.
They sure are, that 50 Shades of Grey. Now, I know we've spoken to Jacqueline about this before, but it's extraordinary how all around the world, everyone is reading this book, 50 Shades of Grey. But welcome to the show, Jacqueline Hallier.
People are going, wow, why is it so amazing? What's so amazing? You know, it's not actually great literature or anything like that. But I think what is so important about this book, I actually believe it speaks very directly to the essence of female sexuality. You know, I actually suspect that people on the whole are a bit kinkier than we mostly will admit. It's interesting that this whole kink thing's coming out now. To me, it's a little bit like where homosexuality was about 50 years ago. You know, we were just moving from thinking that, you know, they were all deviant and abnormal and you shouldn't talk about it. And now I think we're sort of at that same thing that, well, actually, you know, a bit of spanking can actually be quite a pleasurable thing, and that doesn't make you some kind of weirdo.
But do you get lots of clients coming in with that sort of, would you call it a fetish?
I generally use the word kink as the overriding thing.
It
is. It's very common. I mean, I think, like, we have spectrums of sexuality, and I think one of those spectrums is kinkiness. Some people, you know, not interested at all. Some are, like, a little bit interested, and some are, like, well, scarily interested, you know, they've got dungeons in their basement sort of thing. And there are people in the suburbs who have dungeons in their basement.
Wow. Is this book like that? As Michael said, is it an escape for people that they don't feel comfortable talking about it, but they can read about it type thing?
One of the things that's so good about that book is, yeah, partly because it's about all BDSM and that's a little bit different. But what's really nice, I think, is about the way the two main characters relate, right? And if we are going to be looking at kinky sex, because a lot of people think, oh, that's really bad and it's about one person dominating and being a sadist and all that. But what you see in the book is it's actually not about that. It's actually about negotiation. and two people coming together, and essentially what they're doing is they're negotiating their sex life. And so often in, you know, mainstream couples, there actually isn't any negotiation. There's often hardly even any talk around their sex life, right?
Mm-hmm.
For me, one of the really good things that comes out of that book is to say, okay, here are two people who've got, well, initially quite different views of sexuality and what is good sex for them, and they both start, they actually start talking about it, and they both start opening up to each other's point of view and maybe experimenting with it a little bit. In her case, she's experimenting a bit more with, you know, some of the kinky sex. In his case, he's actually experimenting with intimacy because he has no experience of that and she has no experience of the other, you know. So I think that's actually quite special.
Your role, though, as a sex coach, and, you know, I know you get to see, you know, many different couples.
Yeah.
Do you think our take on sex within relationships is quite Victorian in its approach?
Yeah, absolutely. I think sex therapy as a whole is fairly Victorian in its approach, a lot of it, you know. All a little bit sort of dry. Whereas to me, you know, good sex and sex in a relationship, there's as much poetry in it as there is, you know, like jolly good, let's have an orgasm type of stuff.
Yeah. But it was something you just said before. It's about actually talking about it, isn't it? It's about understanding what each partner wants, do you think?
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. And one thing I'm hoping that this book will do is will actually give women permission to actually start talking about some of their desires, right? A lot of women in particular, you know, a lot of us, we're sort of a bit confused because, you know, we like to think that we're, you know, maybe a bit more feminist, we're equal and so forth. So, oh my God, but I have fantasies about being spanked. How does that work? You know, and for the guys, it might be like, oh, how can I possibly spank the mother of my children, the love of my life? Isn't that a bad and horrible thing to do? When in fact it can just be like a yummy, fun thing to do in the bedroom.
Yeah.
You know, it's not about power, it's actually about pleasure.
Jacqueline, thank you for joining us today on the program. It's always interesting talking to you.
Yes.
You get a different insight on life. Definitely.
Yes.
I don't have a dungeon or anything like that.
What, no,
I know. I think, well, there's no room in the studios here.
Thanks, Jacqueline. Thanks for your time.
All right. Always a pleasure. Thanks, guys.
Mind Food Radio, Smart Thinking with Michael McHugh and Ben Starr.
And this is Mind Food Radio, time for my story.
That's right, and this is an extraordinary story. I'd like to welcome to the show Nikki Mennell.
Hello.
Hi. Now, I'm going to start off by saying that you would think this is never going to happen to you. It's that sliding door moment that changes your life forever. Nikki, you had a stressful job. You'd been taking, it had been taking the toll on your health.
Yeah.
Your usually low blood pressure was skyrocketing.
Yeah.
You weren't sleeping and often had migraines, and it was time to leave, and so you finally resigned from that job.
Yeah.
But 4 weeks later, you woke up and you went to the bathroom, and I'll let you pick up your story from here.
Yeah, absolutely. I went to the bathroom and washed my hands. And I noticed that my hand wasn't moving properly, and I just sort of thought that I must have been tired. So I went back into the bedroom and started making the bed, and then I realised there were some drops on the sheets, and what I actually noticed was that I was dribbling, and I thought that was really strange. My husband was just about to leave, so I actually went downstairs to just go and chat to him, and then as I tried to speak, completely different words came out altogether, so... he wasn't actually able to understand what I was saying, so it was quite a shock at that point. I wasn't quite sure what was going on. And then from there, when we couldn't communicate with me speaking, he sat me down and got me a piece of paper, and I tried to write what I wanted to say.
Mm.
But at that stage, my hand had actually given way, so I just sort of drew a squiggly line at that point. From there, he sort of twigged that something wasn't right, so he actually tried to move me to the couch, and as he tried to pick me up, all my legs collapsed underneath me, so he was literally just holding on to me in the air. So he moved me to the couch and called the ambulance, and they were here probably in another 10 minutes after that. So I got to hospital very quickly, which was great. Then once I was in hospital, probably about another 30, 40 minutes later, I actually had a second stroke. And from there, stayed in hospital for about 5 days, but they're unable to determine what actually caused the stroke. So I was 39. I've just turned 40 last month, which was great. So I was very, very happy to celebrate that birthday, given everything that's happened.
Now, the thing is with a stroke, it's important, isn't it, once you've had it or you're having it, is to get medical attention pretty quickly.
Yeah, you need to get it straight away. There's a window of about 4.5 hours at the most. where if you're able to get to hospital, that the doctors are able to help you with some medication in some circumstances. So the time factor is really important.
Is stress a key factor?
I believe it is.
Yeah.
Stress certainly increases your blood pressure, and blood pressure is one of the biggest causes of stroke.
Mm. Heavy drinking, poor diet, smoking, diabetes, high cholesterol. It's, lack of exercise, isn't it? It's a whole range of different triggers.
Oh, absolutely. And each of those triggers work together as well to increase or decrease your thing. But then on the other hand too, like, I didn't have a lot of those. So sometimes it's hard to sort of tell with that what it is that can cause the stroke. But definitely healthy diet, good weight, moving, exercise.
Yeah.
And low sodium diets and things like that are really important. And also just knowing what your cholesterol and your blood pressure numbers are as well, and work to reduce those.
Hey, Nikki, thank you very much for being on the show today. Your story, the My Story, is in our September edition, which will be on sale early August. And thanks for being on the show.
Thank you so much.
Well, that's another episode of Mind Food Radio. What an amazing story from that stroke victim.
Exactly, Nikki. And of course, it can happen to anyone. This is the amazing thing.
Scary, isn't it?
And within those 4 hours, you must get to a doctor. Mm. So Stroke Week is actually coming up in September. But if you want more details in and around that, there's a new story coming out in the latest edition of Mind Food, and we have others on mindfood.com.
Now, if you'd like to send in a My Story, what do we do there, Michael?
Just you can send it to me at michael@mindfood.com or go to our website at mindfood.com. And remember all those prizes and competitions you can enter.
Of course. Now, next week, more great interviews on the way. And don't forget to jump onto mindfood.com. If you missed anything in today's program, you'll find it sitting on the website. Until next week, take care, Michael.
Have a great weekend.
Mind Food Radio Smart Thinking was produced in the studio of Radio Australasia. Produced by Ben Starr and Brian Newington and Patrick Kayrouse. Bogart Torelli speaking.